You mentioned, I believe, that you did come into Valdez on one occasion when you did encounter ice. Do you recall if at that time the vessel was slowed, or can you remember what speed it was going at? Was it already going at a slow speed?
We were coming out of port, sir, and yes. We stayed at about half speed. And I think we went down slow ahead for part of it, just to be safe on that. Mm-hmm.
And did you say that you altered out of the southbound lane?
Sir, I don't think we did. We just maneuvered through the ice, right and left rudder. Now, okay.
Mm-hmm. All right, no further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Armentrout.
Mr. LeCain, yes, yesterday when we were questioning Mr. Kagan, he explained that, and I'm not going to go through the whole long explanation, but anyway, during the evolution of the 10-degree right rudder and then the 20 and then the hard, he said at one point that, and I believe it was somewhere between 20 and the hard, he knew the ship was responding because he heard the clicks. Mm-hmm. Could you explain, and I think he alluded to the fact clicking is the sound of each degree as it is, as compass is passing through that. Mm-hmm. Could you explain that, how that relates, or just what that is that he's hearing as, you know, on the automated system?
Well, the course recorder in the, it wouldn't be an actual sound out of the gyro. It's usually the repeaters and radars, they make a noise. And then you have the course recorder, which makes noise back there. When you change course, you can hear it. So where he was standing, he would be able to hear that noise, the clicking sound. On the older ships where we actually had an analog repeater right in front of the quartermaster, when he changed course, you would hear a definite. But the repeater built into the 2000 system is a digital repeater. There's no moving parts, so there's no clicking sounds here.
Okay, then what I think you're saying is it certainly was not the turn indicator, but it was probably the course recorder that was actually.
I would think that's what
he was,
sir.
Hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the course recorder would, if he could hear that, then the course recorder, depending on the rate of turn, would click, 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 or it could be, if it's very slow. In other words, he would be able to relate that to some function of the ship turning or changing course.
I would say so, sir.
And the other, the only other question I have, following the mishap, at what period of time or between the time that the ship was finally taken to Naked Island, did you functionally or assist in functionally testing the SPIRIT system, both emergency and operation and normal operation? Was it examined or functionally tested following the grounding?
Yes, I wasn't up there when they did it, sir. I understand they did it. That's all I can say. It was the next day, I believe, they checked on it. And see, they were afraid to test it too much, except at high tide, because if the rudder was touching the ground in any place, you start moving rudder around, you could damage it. You know, at the present time, it seemed we had, evidently when they were on the rocks, they were using it. I don't know. I wasn't there. But we used the system when we were floated off of the reef, and it worked fine going down to Naked Island. And we had a Commander Blaze from the Coast Guard, I believe, came out down there and looked at the system. And it seemed to function fine through the whole thing.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
Mr. LeCain, just I think you've done a good job of trying to explain to us the difference between the gyro, the automatic pilot, versus the manual operation, and just to make sure that I'm hearing you correctly, I just need to go through a little bit of it one more time.
Yes, sir.
Maybe some of us were on the impression the first couple of days of testimony that maybe there indeed was, if the vessel is in gyro, that there is indeed a manual override if you turn the wheel X number of degrees or X number of turns, and I think you're saying that if it's in gyro and you grab the wheel and turn it, nothing indeed happens.
That's correct, sir. If you turn the wheel within a gyro, you'll get nothing.
Yes. Okay. Can you look at Exhibit 12, Charlie, again, page 214?
Are you talking about
the chart?
The chart, yes.
The newest one, correct. The last page, figure 2-8, the CRT display.
Okay. Is this, sir?
That's correct.
Okay.
This is the display that, one would, whether one is in gyro or manual operation, the heading in degrees at the top and the heading rate and rudder angle, that's what you'd be seeing.
What you'd be seeing, sir, yes.
Okay. The CRT. If I'm operating this vessel, how would I know that I'm in, just looking at the CRT, how would I know that I'm in gyro?
Well, there's a couple ways. You see the N says, letter N, and it points over and says gyro mode.
Mm-hmm.
Then on M, it says present steering mode gyro. So there's also instructions on how to use the gyro there. So if you read them below N there, see instructions, select inputs, marked with boxes, press
okay.
gyro.
That would be, and that's easily seen looking at this CRT.
Oh yes, sir. It was nice about this system. You have it. I mean, you're looking at a nice system. It's state of the art.
Okay, so if you're in manual, it would say present steering mode, manual.
Yes, and it would say manual mode there too, sir.
Okay. You want to ask? Go ahead.
I was just wondering whether, when in manual, do those instructions disappear from the scope?
I don't recall, sir. Uh-huh. I believe so.
Sure. Thanks, Jim. I was going to ask that anyway. Okay. One other question, Mr. LeCane. You talked a little bit about, I guess, in relation to Commander Waldron, a question about ice. We've heard about ice from Mr. Cousins, and can you give us some indication, approximation, estimation of the size of the ice chunks? Or I don't think I've heard yet a definition or a estimation of the size. Can you do that?
Sir, I wasn't there that night, so I can't tell you how big the ice was.
Okay. How about in the ice that you, well, thank you. That's fine.
Okay.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I just have one follow-up question that Mr. Armentrout asked. Mr. LeCane, when you discuss the synchronization of the gyro repeaters and you hear this clicking sound, does each click represent a fraction of a degree or a degree?
It's a fraction of a degree. It's not just, I forget what fraction, but it's not just a degree. It's much more accurate than that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, since we asked to follow up, any parties have follow-up questions? Mr. Kane, thank you for your time and testimony. I have 9:35. Let's take a 15-minute break. We will return at 9:50.
And we'll be back with more live coverage of the NTSB hearings at 9:50. In the meantime, we've just concluded the testimony, rather technical and rather lengthy testimony, from the second mate of the Exxon Valdez, Lloyd LeCane.
What we learned new in here was not all that much. A lot of this was going over familiar territory. It is filling in the pieces of the puzzle aboard the Exxon Valdez. LeCane is the third officer in charge down from the captain, and he was not on the bridge at the time that the vessel ran aground. Like the chief mate, he was also asleep, and LeCane was in fact scheduled to relieve Greg Cousins, the third mate, the man at the helm. Cousins was feeling pretty confident about the job he was doing and elected not to call LeCane to the bridge. LeCane didn't seem to criticize Cousins for that decision. He said, "Oh, I was there and I was ready to be called," and pretty much left it at that. Much of the discussion centered around the autopilot and whether or not that's engaged, whether or not there's any alarm that goes off if you try to maneuver the ship and it is in autopilot. And probably the most important fact we found out today was that there is no alarm. So if someone tried an emergency maneuver when the autopilot was set, nothing would have happened and there would have been no alarm to tell them that they would have been in autopilot.
Yeah, I think if you watch the progression of these technical questions, especially from the NTSB investigator, in this case it was Richard Johnson, and from Commander Darrell Waldron of the Coast Guard, you can see that their concerns are with the question of whether or not it was possible for this thing to have been in autogyro when they thought that, in fact, they had actually changed it back to hand steering. One question considered, they asked Lacaine to describe in detail what the steering console of the vessel looked like, what indicators tell you whether you're in hand or gyro steering, what kind of a button it is that you push to go to gyro or to hand steering. In fact, it's a spring-loaded button. It's not one of these sort of touch buttons that you find, as described before, in a microwave oven. So you have to actively push down this thing. The question was, is it possible to think you've pushed it and not actually to have happened? So they're right down to the absolute most precise details, but the real implication is the question of whether it was possible that they were in autopilot when they thought they were actually hand steering.
The other thing is that since this is the National Transportation Safety Board, it does have an eye on future changes regarding equipment on board vessels, and some of the questions seem to point in that direction, whether there need to be additional alarms. And while they didn't address that specifically, it certainly you get a sense that they're looking for possible changes that they might recommend, things that might keep this from happening again. Some of the other really technical discussion centered on the fathometer, a meter that tells you how far below the water the keel of the ship is. One of the main questions was that fathometer alarm set? In other words, when you reach a certain depth or a certain shallowness, will that alarm go off? It was still not clear what depth that was set to. Everyone says that it is standard practice to set it, but no one seems to know what it was set to. In this case, the person testifying deferred to the captain and said that that's really a decision that the captain had to make. Lacaine said he was not aware what that was set to. That was one line of questioning we heard the Coast Guard and NTSB investigators follow time and time again. The implication is here that if they would have been getting in shallow territory, had the alarm been set, that alarm would have gone off and perhaps might have alerted Greg Cousins and the people on the bridge that they were in trouble.
Yeah, what you do get a much better picture of the sort of high-tech world that these people live in on the bridge. Enormous numbers of technical navigation aids, and a lot of redundancy. In other words, that there are two and three alarm systems and indication systems to let people know what's going on. The testimony today, in fact, makes it sound as if it's very difficult to make a mistake without having an alarm or some indication very rapidly of what's going on.
The other thing that we get is, for those of us who are non-seamen and non-navigators, a very clear sense of how the lines of authority are drawn. The helmsman basically turns the wheel, and when someone said, Mr. Kagan steering the ship, Lacaine says, no, I was steering the ship. We're talking about times that he is in command. It's very clear that the officer is giving the command, the able-bodied seaman is there only to turn the wheel, and the officer is looking over his shoulder at each moment, checking the gauges and making sure that they are doing just that. And that's the way Lacaine certainly describes that the job is done. As second officer, Lacaine is the one mainly responsible for navigation. He's the one who sets up the charts and decides the courses in advance that the ship will follow.
One thing we got, of course, too, was the standard question that each witness has been asked, and that is, were you able to detect any odor of alcohol or any sign of impairment on the part of the captain? Lacaine said, as all the officers have so far, no, he did not see any sign of alcohol use.
Captain Hazelwood came up again in another area when they asked whether he had conversations with the captain, and really there was very little contact between Lacaine and the captain. Lacaine was basically taking his orders from the chief mate. And so, again, the captain does not appear to be appears to be in the background. He is, you know, certainly appears to be in command, but in many respects was in the background, was not interacting with a lot of people on the bridge at the time that this whole accident occurred. And Captain Hazelwood remains an enigmatic figure in this entire episode.
Absolutely. There's even more of this sense of isolation. We heard from James Kunkel and got a more emotional, more personal kind of view of what goes on, what kind of communication there is among the officers on these vessels. But with Lacaine again, as with the ABs, the able-bodied seamen who testified yesterday, there is this sense of isolation, and the sense especially that after a casualty like this has occurred, you believe that every one of these people is very sharply aware that there's going to be a board of inquiry, and they're already taking a kind of a legal stand. They're not communicating much about the accident. I mean, it's startling that this man could come up here and say that he did not ask his fellow officers in very great detail what had gone on. There was no talk about responsibility for it. At least from what he was willing to tell the Board of Inquiry, very little communication went on except about very immediate things that were taking place on the ship.
And the same thing holds true with Third Mate Greg Cousins, the person who is directly below Lord Lacaine, the person who was at the helm at the time, the fellow who Kane was scheduled to replace. And yet Lacaine said he basically offered personal support, but didn't try to find out from Cousins what went wrong. And Lacaine is the man who was supposed to be at the helm at the time that the Exxon Valdez was approaching Bligh Reef, and yet he did not ask Cousins, or at least as far as what he's told the safety board, did not really get from Cousins an explanation of what went wrong. Another interesting thing that came up was the ice issue. This is something that since day one, it is said by Cousins and by other people that the vessel was steering to avoid ice. Lacaine said that by the time light came around, he did not see ice close to the vessel. He tried to pinpoint it on the map, but said this may be fuzzy, but there was clearly no ice in the immediate vicinity of the vessel and within close range.
You know, the implication throughout here, and this came up very early after the accident, within a day or two, there was a persistent rumor that these Exxon tankers have been using ice as an excuse to change shipping lanes, change courses, and reduce, even if it's only by a matter of a few miles, the distance they have to travel to get out of Prince William Sound. The implication is that commanders have been saving time by changing courses and have always told the Coast Guard that what they were doing was trying to avoid ice.
So far, we've gotten no verification of that. They asked that question yesterday of the people who ran the radar at the Valdez Marine Traffic Safety Center, the people who track the vessels. And those folks said, to their knowledge, the captains were not cutting the course, cutting corners, and literally cutting corners, trying to get out of Prince William Sound faster. But those types of questions have arisen, and again, much of this comes from the line of inquiry. Unlike some investigations or like congressional hearings, people here don't make statements. The folks, it's more legalistic in a sense, and they're basically the questioners are trying to build a record. In the case of the Coast Guard or some of the interested parties, they're trying to get certain facts into the record that will protect their position, in a sense, cover their tails. And we've seen those types of questions asked in order to bring out information that any of the parties, the state, Alyeska, Exxon, the Coast Guard, they want to make sure that certain bits of information are there in the record when the time comes for this whole thing to be evaluated and for the report to be written.
You know, we've heard now an hour and a half of fairly technical, fairly dry testimony from Second Mate Lloyd Lacaine. The upcoming witness list looks like, at least from a personal a view of what went on personally here, it'll be a lot more interesting. Our next witness up is Jerzy Glowacki, the chief engineer on the Exxon Valdez, who is described in testimony from the radio operator as being one of the officers of the ship who joined the captain in drinking on the afternoon prior to the time that they left Valdez.
At that point, we do have to make one correction. When we started our broadcast, I mentioned that Lacaine was the second officer involved in that drinking incident. That is not the case. Lacaine was not there. It was, in fact, the radio operator, and so was Josie Glowacki and the radio operator who were said to be involved with this, with drinking before they got on the ship. And in fact, that's what's contained in the documents provided by the National Transportation Safety Board. They detail the account of these fellows hitting two different bars in Valdez and putting down a few drinks before they got on board. So it is highly likely that the issue will come up when Mr. Glowacki gets on the stand. Interestingly enough, the radio operator involved in that incident is not on the witness list, and I've been wondering where he is. We've heard from a lot of people. Some of them at times seem almost peripheral to what's going on, and yet someone whose testimony is important in this, and the one crew member who so far has come forward and talked about drinking is not on the witness list.
Yeah, that is interesting. I suspect that in addition to the sort of drinking testimony or the drinking questions that will be directed at Glowacki, there will probably be questions about some of the maneuvers that the captain evidently tried to perform to get the vessel off the reef. There have been questions about what the commands were on the engine room telegraph, whether he was going had engines astern or engines forward, and what speeds he was making. This should give us a little better sense of exactly what the captain was trying to do while his first mate was down below, discovering that the vessel really probably wasn't stable enough to go off the reef.
And so far we haven't had really strong testimony detailing exactly what went on there. Cousins touched on it briefly, but the chief mate was not involved. He was down in another part of the ship checking the cargo and checking the oil that was flowing out. We heard the second officer, Lloyd Lacaine, was also not on the bridge at the time that they were doing these maneuvers to extricate the ship. So perhaps we will find out some more about that from the chief engineer of the Exxon Valdez. Also coming up today, Frank Iarossi, president of Exxon Shipping Company, a familiar figure to people who've been following these the action on the Exxon Valdez, the man who gave many of the early press conferences and has been spokesman for Exxon Shipping since the early days. Also, Captain William Deppe, who is here as asking the questions for Exxon Shipping Company. Kind of an interesting role reversal there.
Absolutely, because he, in fact, was the captain who relieved Captain Joseph Hazelwood immediately after the accident. So, in a way, we should have another seaman's view of what went on, you know, assuming that Captain Deppe is willing to talk in any kind of detail. I think that things are going to get hot when both these gentlemen come to the stand, because there have been a lot of questions so far about what Exxon's standard operating procedure really was, and a lot of seeming gaps in what the actual practice was.
And also on the testimony list at the very end of the day will be Dennis Kelso, who has been extremely outspoken about Alyeska's response, Exxon's response, and the way this entire thing has been happening. And we can expect that we're going to hear some very strong testimony from Kelso. Every time he's gotten in front of the stand, he has come across very eloquent and also very strong and very powerful. So we can expect that there's going to be some important testimony here, and some pretty interesting stuff, probably some pretty heated testimony.
Yeah, absolutely. You were talking about the purpose of these inquiries as a means for the different parties to defend their position, or at least to establish their positions, legally speaking, and for the record. This will sort of finish out the triangle between the Coast Guard, Exxon Shipping Company, Alyeska, and the state. We'll have a chance, I think, to see just exactly where everybody stands at the end of this testimony.
We'll be back with more live coverage from the NTSB hearings into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. Coverage of these hearings come to you from KSKA Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.